22, tout monde, antenne, corps étrangers.
Good morning. Thank you very much to be with us this morning for the second day of the seminar. I'm just gonna really quickly go through the first day we spent yesterday, and we're beginning on the morning looking for safe places. Safe places hide in the light or in the darkness. Sometimes really close, sharing toxicity, porosity. Jephthé Carmil talked about the radicality of a coin in Haiti and the circulation of a spectral presence of the revolution and the famous maroon figures, François Macendall, from hand to hand. But he also talked about the potential scene of a slave port. Nadia Comfort talked about another scene which took place in Algeria, where women play with veil and unveiled bodies to recover dignity and to hide inside the colonial gaze their strategy of liberation. Nadia Yala Kusikedi opened, as she said, a toxic potential space for racial hospitality, trying to turn the Baldwin's phantasma about Paris as a safe place. And after that, Philippa Cesar came back to the soil, a soil as a matter, as a storyteller, and also a soil as a board for an ecological, political, and a political project, as Amilcar Cabral, leader of PAIGC, imagined it. With Philippa, Ruthie Wilson Gilmore showed the potential of images, but also a problem, the vision, and the animistic power of the filmic matter itself that would contain somewhere in its own body before being imprint, a spectral sense of violence. Kodak create perhaps camera and films to sell chocolates and to repeat murders. Onyeka Igwe and Kyaria Finn Nelson approach bodies as analytic tools, a technology, perhaps able to recover, to extract, and to reappropriate a physical inheritance. In the afternoon, Zach Blast imagined the magical approach of a big data system as a power of transparency, selling predictive imaginary. Christa Blumlinger went through the visual world of Aaron Farocki as an archaeology of the image that attempts to make visible the image inside the images. And to close that long first day, we spent time with Denise Ferreira da Silva and Arjuna Neumann, and we try with them to experiment a non-human perspective with a drone as a tool of representation that break the scale of the human habitus. So we close that first day trying to talk about visibility and invisibility, darkness and light, and the different regime of images, their toxicity, and their potential. Today, it's a day with a central, we'll say a central scene, because we talked about that concept of scene yesterday, which is the ocean. And we'll talk about oceans in different manner, This afternoon, we will spend more time with oceanic fabulation and the potential storytellings that can be developed with the ocean. And this morning, we'll be more focused on the ocean as a resource, going from the surface to the deep ocean, and talking about many extraction, and not only talking about extraction by itself, but also about the representation of a politic of extraction, and in a certain way, the representation of the struggle under the surface and the new zone of struggles. So I'm super happy to welcome our speaker of this morning, and the first one is Rachel O'Reilly, that will talk. It's okay. It's a kind of case studies, but I think it's wider than that. We'll see with Rachel an ongoing project, which is a film, and talking about a specific context in Australia about extraction. We will see after that two films by Lorenzo Pesani. Lorenzo can be with us on the today, and he can be with us on Skype. So we'll see two films that he did with Forensic Architecture. And after that, Margarita Mendez will close that first session, the morning sessions, with another film and project that she did with the Inhabitants, the collective Inhabitants, about the deep ocean mining. So we'll circulate about that question of extraction during that first conversation this morning, and always going from the question by themselves of extraction, but also their representations, and so how a gesture of activism can be done with images too. So thank you, Rachel, it's you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I've actually never been to Kiasma or La Colonie before, and I've been wanting to for some time. So I'm extremely happy to be here, and very sorry that I'm absolutely exhausted from trying to make my first mini film. But I think I could have possibly participated in the conversation last night, and I just wanted to say that I really care about these kinds of spaces. I got into art quite accidentally. I was studying literature and I was invited to collaborate on a national festival that crossed between art and activism in Australia. And my kind of life changed for the better from then onwards. So I really am happy to keep being invited back to these spaces, and I know how much work it takes to keep them alive. And also I should mention that Louis and Philippa also separately offered to edit this film of mine, so I think it's kind of didn't happen in the end because we were all too busy, but yeah, it makes sense for you all to see it. So this is I'm going to go in the proper artistic order and show the film first and then talk about the context afterwards. And it's a collaboration with the visuals. The visuals are a collaboration with an architect pair called Palace, Ben Reynolds and Vaya Medina, who I met at the Overnight when I first got some funding to research the extractivism in Australia. Before that time, I was just doing it, whenever I could, no money, etc. So I also just wanted to mention that there's a few different interlocutors that change depending on which direction the research goes. Most recently, Roxley Foley, who is the son of the main Black Power Aboriginal historian Gary Foley in Australia, has been a conversation partner that has made a huge difference for making me be confident that I'm doing research that contributes something. Juliri Ingra and Jackie Johnson are sisters and Gurangaran elders of my hometown. And more recently, Sarah Keenan at Birkbeck Critical Legal Studies has been a great person to speak to around the colonial legal history. So, yeah, without further ado, I am going to try and... There's no sound yet. It's not the final edit. No other qualifications, I don't think, are necessary at this stage. So I'm going to try and read the voiceover at the same time. First, they will introduce your local landscape to Wall Street in case it did not play enough of a role in the previous boom. They will tell you it's exciting that they can deepen the harbour for bigger gas ships, that a dredger from a Dutch port will visit to cut and to suck. My hometown of Gladstone on Gerangerang land was once the capital of a failed North colony. It industrialised only when 8,000 kilometres of bauxite-rich land was excised from West Cape communities in the early 60s for alumina refining. The people at the Mapoon Mission were evicted at gunpoint, had their houses set on fire for their land. In the settler world picture, the main barriers to extraction are distance, credit, and the elements themselves. The Australian state nationalised its geological data in 1946. Groundwater was not aggregated until 1983 at the encouragement of the United Nations in Bandung. People think that planetary computation means capitalism is getting more accurate. But the irrationality of the operating system screens. This is an exact copy of one diagram used by a gas company to communicate the install of the industry on my hometown. Clipped from the image, aside from earthliness, are thousands of possible wellheads over an area 600 times the size of a standard coal mine. The whistleblower said that she was shocked to find only a concept. An entire chapter on groundwater impacts to the largest underground water basin on Earth was permitted to be withheld from the environmental impact statement. Also not included was any plan to dispose of the waste, toxic brine fluid. When I tell Jaliri they are building the pipeline through to her Gerangerang land, she says she feels sick to her stomach. Fully capitalist concepts of landed property only consolidated after the British invaded Australia. An Irish-born shipping officer with no legal training whatsoever, Robert Richard Torrens, developed a title by registration system that drew a false equivalent between landed property and shipped property. Its mirror and curtain principles did away with the need to bring deed records from the past to a land sale. The settler faces forward with a mirror in his hand, a floaty runner on an all-white background. The principle of the mirror within the Torrens titling system from the late 1830s records just the owner's name and says the state's registry reflects the owner's interests exactly. During the first wave of his deployment, despite the ready sophistication of surveying technologies, the security of his finance was far more important than precise parcel boundaries on land maps. The curtain principle says he can confidently draw the blinds on anyone with a genuine interest in his property, if their names aren't already mentioned in the register. It doesn't say they don't exist. It says he is legally entitled to ignore them. The social drama of retrospection in land claims was eliminated. The totality of the contingency in violence is not depicted. For nearly 200 years, every corporate poem has tried to stay attached to that body. Colonialism is a shit shot based on this absolute dephysicalization of the second body's relationship to the soil. Nobody says some didn't do right by an otherwise or mess with the curtains. But for 200 years, Aboriginal organisers gave the settler many shots at something more resembling justice. The curtain only started failing in the 1970s as people claimed back their land. After Mabo, farming lobbies in the west of Australia were recruited by the mining industry to block these alternative energies. Today, it is the mining companies that occupy the farmer's land as coexistence that for him turned out far worse. After the first wave of invasion, they said that the narrative of the place should aim to be legal, and this was post-produced. Then they said it should be assimilative, prone to ongoing eliminations. For about 14 years, they said it could have small pockets of fully consulted indigeneity. As capital reaches the limits of land use, the estate begins to eat itself. In Marx, rural idiot was a mistranslation and not an insult. It just referred to empirically fixed horizons and isolations of country life. The woman at the edge is not the artist but a categorically ambivalent white woman who looks likely to refuse the bounds of the neo-contractual scenario. After Europe's coal crises, Australian exports scaled up with the open cut and the machine of the drag line. The worker was pulled from the identifactory of the underground, atomised and exposed to fly-in, fly-out relations. Things still seem mechanically pulverous, but fracking is more of the era of nuclear experimentation. Labour politics are almost technically impossible. You cannot strike the new mine after the equipment has been installed without killing somebody. Contracts are ludicrously high but deadlined. Workers are lured from businesses and trades that can't compete with devilish contracts. The factory gets distributed across a special economic earth where collectivity is only possible at the topsoil. Today, the fractal image of the settler farmer, which is not the same as much more variegated real ones, is mourned at the ship's masthead by the same logic of what the legal form had already stripped before. A man appears on repeat with the dream of purchasing and building a viable estate in a suitable climate with a long-term protected relationship to buyers' markets. The violence of his first decades got replaced by his inheritors, but none of the original traces which shot their drawing rights beyond the line of the law were assumed to stand to be inherited. Between the mine and the dredging operation, dephysicalized I states groove their licentious lawfulness. Dredging metaphorizes unwelcome retrospections and the drama of double bookkeeping the planet. The idea that if you pick up this turtle, that seagrass and that dugong and drop them on this other point of the map and they survive, which is impossible because they are not really even the same turtles, they are supposed to have no net loss value. For Marx, the corporation was a form of production that was uniquely terrible. It preserved the fundamental injustice of capitalism, private production, without the one thing, private responsibility, that might have operated as a check on its exercise. Let shareholders be pronounced only partially liable, and they will scarcely remember the existence of the bank, except when they occasionally receive some interest for their investment. Limit the shareholders' liability and the bank itself becomes a delusion. The problem was not only the enhancement of self-interest, but the new modes of forgetting. Toxicity without a deeper and more lateral history sets the ground only for an audit of the state. What material time is it when law has stopped being able to blend with these most favoured citizenships? Populism pattern recognises itself, but elides the difference of uncommon times on water objects. The fuzzy borders of farmer bodies are fabricated to be dilated when the corporation claims back its vote. King William IV wrote in his 1836 letters of patent that wherever possible, nothing in the settlement project should affect the rights of Aboriginal people to the actual occupation or enjoyment of their land. Richard Torrens ignored the Crown's order and proposed an Aboriginal protection agent and the reserve system as his concession. The curtain of the outcrypting machine, coupled with repeating new beginnings of title experiences, informs the collective delusion and securitisation of the largest psychic settlement. If the ship gets all its parts replaced, is it still the same ship? The settler was a Thesusian paradox. He had to be made, invested in, and rewarded for the loyalty in order for the whole thing to expand. The metaphysical husk or user of the operating system meets the language of the gas companies in a morning. How can history be made by the settler if nightmares do not burden him or contaminate his own categories? Robert Torrens got on a boat and promoted his registry system directly to Western Canada, after which it quickly spread across the empire to Hawaii, the Philippines, the Dominican Republic, Ireland, Israel, Malaysia, New Zealand, Singapore, Thailand, and a number of US states. A model like it is used by the International Monetary Fund since the mid-2000s to dispossess peasants from their land. Once the registry system is installed, it is noted to be not particularly good at knowing or keeping track of how land is used or monitoring the cumulative impact of developments. Some commentators have described it as a hospital for capitalist subjectivity and property history in its elimination of the legal need to look backwards. How do we read these images that denotate pulverization as property turned back towards the fragility of land itself through pixel spreads? When narratives of contamination tend to auto-institute a spectator of broken law lines and settler reason inheritances. In the move from handheld to droned capture, the complaint reshapes its I state as smooth Euclidean space. Data gets sent into the mouth of inspection. The image as property, but then some, begins to make an argument beyond its owners, while also being brokenness at the skin face. This is not quite memory, but something else, a kind of proxy of a trauma geometry where the sediments themselves vomit all the untold stories. Militant pastoralism otherwise goes better with parliamentary civilization than you think. Breathe. Habitability trespassing, looping now on totally uneven moving ground shots. Sweat, piss, the body in its heatedness, as carbon dioxide, mucus, bacteria, shit, respiration, transpiration, decomposition. Carbon is a cycle of exchange that challenges the conceits of a single man's lifetime. The criminal authorship is time itself. So unless there's any immediate questions, I'll just say a few things and then open to a discussion, because I'm mostly interested in the discussion. And I'm not assuming that everyone... I mean, if things aren't graspable, I really need to know that, basically. So... um, This research started, the fracking was approved in 2009, and it came through the port that was selected as the port that was going to be the development for the install across the whole state was my hometown harbour. And four generations of my family grew up there. There's a lot of biography which I can get carried away with, so I'm just going to not actually mention it until people ask questions about it. But the main things to know also are that my father had a fishing store on the waterfront, so everyone that was watching the transformation of the harbour from the dredging situation was telling me and my father information about what was going on that was completely eventful and absolutely undocumented for more than 2 or 3 years. The second kind of index is that when it was approved, the museum that it chose to sponsor was my own art museum where I was curating cinema at the time. I'd actually put in my notice for totally other reasons about a month before, and then the sponsorship happened as I was leaving my institution. These police cars are sponsored by the gas company that was sponsoring my art museum. So this all, that's the constellation. This gives you an idea of the city. It's a population of about 30,000 people. An extreme industrialization happened there since the 60s. And this is the only rigorous historical document on the history of the city on the left-hand side. It draws on rigorous early anthropology records of Aboriginal groups in the area. In the book, they disappear entirely from the 1930s and turn up in 1988 at bicentenary celebrations as two, quote, original inhabitants in a city where there's more than 5,000 Aboriginal and Islander people out of 30,000. So that gives you an idea of the coloniality of the situation. The view on the right is the view from my father's fishing store. And what I pulled yesterday from the discussion was this question of how one starts to think, you know, through a landscape. And also, I can't remember who it was talking about developing a project that could include your own body. These women I just included this so you get an idea of the relationship between race and environment, but this is a... this is a turtle racing festival where after the turtles lay their eggs in the island where the gas now is, they all have to get back to the ocean, and people from the work from the industries used to go over on Saturdays mornings and jump on the turtles to race them to the edge of the water. The remarkable thing about Australian extractivism is the state just puts all of its richest data online. You can go online and check out where you want to mine in Australia extremely easily. What it doesn't put on there, because it doesn't know very well, is the water situation. So this red blob in the middle is the biggest underground water basin in the world. And all the blue dots are all fracking wells, basically. One of the reasons, out of the many obvious emerging reasons, that I wanted to do this project also is because I'm an educator as well. So I really believe in aesthetic education, and the activism was very strong. So it went straight to the richest farming lands and the widest farming lands in Australia when it was installed, which was. Is evident of how little they knew about what they were going to do. I didn't know at the time that eventually they would be moving to Aboriginal lands at the centre of the country. That's happening right now. They're about to approve the fracking of Aboriginal land leases in the Northern Territory. That's a whole other conversation. But I was interested in this absolute contradiction of settler kind of environmentalism. And that's also... The protest that we saw, um, the the coming together of environmentalists and farmers who are traditionally not an alliance at all was happening in a part of my state which is notorious for the strongest and most long-standing Aboriginal resistance movements that were famous for making farmers leave their pastoral setups for more than 20 years or 30 years during that first wave of settlement. The sheep farmers would turn up and they'd put their sheep on the land, which is the way that they were allowed to keep free property. And then this guerrilla resistance in that area would kick them off their land and they'd have to come back and recolonize the space that they wanted. So none of that history was getting told for... I mean, this story is never told in the fracking activism. That gives you just an idea of the legal situation. It's not really representative of anything except the law, but you get an idea of the extent to which the land rights movement claimed certain spaces back that they thought they weren't interested in developing. And so now a lot of the fracking is going to those areas. So this project started, I was trying to write about it and I was failing because everything I knew was either gossip or would, you know, send me to court, basically. It was because of the scale of corruption. I was at a residency surrounded by artists and I was drawing the shape of my argument with in studio visits at the Yanvan Ike. And after about 6 months of not being able to write... I had a series of about 9 drawings of the plot of the argument, and the drawings became something that I knew I needed to materialize in order to keep telling the story. These are also a collaboration with the same people that made the visuals of the film. So all the visuals of the film actually come out of these 3D drawings. And we went back in there and put cameras in those 3D drawings to make the film. I'm quite perfectionistic about framing the ideas, but I'm not a control freak. So actually, some of the elements of the drawings I didn't actually see until they were exhibited for the first time because of the kind of Chinese whispers of the layers in which they're assembled. My main kind of labour informant has been my uncle, who will feed me every time I go back there to do research. That's him checking out my... the work. This is the epochal flip in the full capitalization of land between the ship and the earth. So I'll just leave it on that slide, and then we can have a discussion.
I don't know, if you want to react to that first presentation, I got a microphone there. Ruth?
Thanks. Thank you, Rachel. That was really fantastic. Is this on? Okay. I have what might or might not be a simple question. Why mercantile in the title? What are you doing?
That's more... So on the one hand, it is the mercantile legal innovation that makes the earth modeled on a ship, right? So the era that we live with is the residue of that attitude that literally makes a property a boat kind of thing, a forward-looking, totally displaced vehicle of speculation, basically. But in the title, I didn't really talk about that, but maybe that's a discussion, but I think part of the way that I work and the way that I collaborate and the reasons why I haven't made this a non-profit institution or whatever is also about, refusing to... fully capitalize on a history that's not mine as an attitude towards cultural industry production. So I think against the persistence of the mercantile is about a relationship to the earth, but it's also about refusing to be this guy, you know, in the cultural industries, which I think it's more of a kind of note to self, or a note about practice that works at a speed and at a level of collaboration that's trying to resist the logic that's continuous with the kind of settler condition, basically, which I think, global art, if you call art global, then that the settler colonies have been absolutely essential for developing the concept of a fully liquid global art world, also with practices that deal with these histories as well. So in that's the kind of spirit in which I'm trying to kind of just mark that as something that I try to deal with or work against or something.
Do you think, I guess I just can't hear myself. Do you think that mercantile should compel us, your audience, your collaborators in thought here, to think differently about neoliberalism? That's one question. My second question is, what is the power to you of using a metaphor of capitalism to disavow capitalist relations?
I don't think I'm using mercantile. It's practice against the mercantile, right? So the mercantile is the thing that formats the ordinary commoditization of practices. I do, like, for me, there is this question, like, you know, when Cedric Robinson writes about what mercantilism was, he writes about this ultimate competitive environment where people assume, and this is really interesting, people, you know, and the mercantilists were critiqued by the capitalists of that era in the sense that I think it was Smith who said, like, you've got it all wrong. There is the possibility to have unlimited accumulation. And the mercantilists were accused of having small imaginations for seeing the earth as a limited space of capitalization. And their model of capital, or pre-capital, was of basically absolute competition, knowing full, like, the scarcity of the situation. And I think that attitude is definitely, you know, present in, you know, that is the present somehow. But I'm not a political economist. I can't say we are living in a neo-mercantile moment. But I think, in the sense that, you know, as the economy retreats into spaces, the economy retreats into spaces that are going to be the productive spaces, and leaving out more and more spaces from the most productive parts of the economy, there is this way in which, you know, money is being made from here to there and there, rather than having this global picture of the economy. And so I was thinking about, like, what, like, if I was to think about what it meant to say that we live in a neo-mercantile moment, like, is that an accurate representation of the way many states are actually governing themselves right now? And I think there's something in it, but I can't really be that confident because I'm not doing the analysis. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I disagree with you, but this is probably not the place to have the debate. But it's really interesting food for thought. And what about the metaphor?
I'm not sure I'm using it in the way that you think I'm using it. I mean, I'm saying that the land is modeled.
Talked about not wanting to capitalize, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
But what would be the difference saying practice against the persistence of capital? I'm trying to make it clear that the land is modeled in the spirit of the mercantile spirit. No, like no Australian will think about that, right? Because this is like treated as British legal history. It's not treated as Australian history. I will think about it more, but I feel like I'm introducing the term in order to have it be the logic that is understood as the logic that is modeling or being naturalized as the logic. So if that's the thing that's naturalized, to say, you know, that it's a kind of base thing that's resisted I think it's, you know, it is a kind of note to self somehow. Yeah.
Hi, thank you. I actually just have a very quick question, which is, could you talk more about that really interesting quote that you put up by Torres?
He comes up with this the year before. It's not, I mean, I also don't, I didn't put more of him in the film because I'm not interested in him as a figure. But the context is that the year before this system gets installed in Australia, they have an inquiry in British Parliament as to how they're going to free up more land with the capital from slavery that's coming back to Britain, and the capitalists want to make bigger factories in Britain, and they want to get the aristocrats off their land to have more land to make bigger factories, and they want the colonial project to happen at the same time. So they were trying to get a similar system happening in England, and the aristocratic class were against it because they were concerned that, first of all, their relationship to their own property would start to seem less natural. And also that at the time they understood that it would make land seem more fictional than real. The concept of property seemed more fictional than real. So it didn't get through, and it only comes back to England in 1925. The biggest resistance, obviously, to modelling land on the concept of a ship, is that land has qualities. If you draw up a block and you turn it into 20 different properties, each one of those properties is going to have different particular elements of it that's completely different to the neighbouring property. That if you're going to buy or produce anything from that land, you probably want to know the difference between those 20 properties in the same area. So that was the resistance to the model, and it's just like a kind of Jedi mind trick. He just flips it and says, like, if that is your resistance to modeling this on a ship, we can think about how great the shipping system has been for knowing the special individuality of a ship as it travels across the whole globe, something like that. It's completely crazy and it's completely ordinary to how we think about property, right? That's the kind of flipping moment.
But it's kind of like an interesting de-liquification of the maritime as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the ocean part, I'm looking forward to the rest of the conversation today. It started to come in after I started attending the meetings after the harbour was destroyed, and they were dividing the destroyed harbour into bits, like itemized bits of things that we had to argue to not be more destroyed. So they'll say, you know, we've got this much seagrass, we've got that many dugongs, we've got this many other. And the way in which they kind of propertized all of those things in order to eliminate them was, really obvious. But also the extent to which that completely ruins any kind of imagination in the activism for dealing with the situation I found also really horrific, actually. Like, so we had activists sitting at that meeting saying, like, okay, well, you know, we want 25% less dugongs destroyed next year, you know, this kind of thing. So you have to, like, speak the language of economy fully itemized in order to, like, revalue the environment, something like that.
Thanks, Rachel. Thanks for that great presentation and the great animation. I wanted to talk a bit about animation itself and its relation to diagramming. So I've seen your drawings, which are kind of, maybe you could think about them as diagrams of fracking as a stack, you know, a stack that reaches into the earth and sits on the land, but has implications above and below. So you have this diagrammatic reading of how fracking functions, and then from diagramming you go to modeling. And you know, when I looked at the animation in the form it is now, what strikes you is the kind of the denaturalizing nature of it. It's the stasis and the pinkness and the kind of the stasis in space, you know. And then when you talk about the torrents, kind of the torrents mode of propertization, you talk about that as modeling as well. The torrents himself modeled, that, you know, the actual process of propertization is a modeling. So is it that that animation is a kind of objective correlative for the kind of modeling that the torrents property claim does? Is that so? In other words, it's a question about animation and question about the kind of the political aesthetic of animation, like why you chose it. Because I think it works, but I'd like to talk a bit about the denaturalizing role that animation plays, but how that enables us to see the torrents propertization process and then in a way create a relation between the long duration of the torrents propertization process and the gas imaginary that's ongoing at the moment with fracking. So yeah, a question about animation.
Yeah, I mean, when I made the drawings in the 3D space, I never thought that I would use them for a film. So then, and you can see that in some of the, just like the crowd, for example, you know, are a kind of blob, right? But they're also a blob because we didn't have time to render them properly. But somehow that makes sense, you know? But also that crowd, like that, I think Occupy, you know, first of all, I hate conceptual art. I think what I'm trying to point to is the failure of conceptualism. And I think the history of Torrens' title is about the failure of the colonial project, right? Because, as you know, that image is so violent and it's so straightforward, and obviously colonialism is not that image, right? There's so many things that you leave in leaving all the actual violence out, besides from that fractal diagram. I'm trying to like make the perversity of cleanliness be really straightforward somehow. And I hope that happens. I'm not saying like this film, like, you know, but I do feel like the audience for this film is actually a settler audience that are occupying this space and making them think that they are in this fully programmed apartheid environment, basically. Because the activism doesn't deal with that at all, like on the East Coast. So on the East Coast, the activism has... It took 4 years for them to put an Aboriginal protagonist in the East Coast activism. And that's what I was responding to by producing that image of the law, basically. When I present with Roxley, it's a whole other presentation, just to make that obvious. But yeah, I think the crude, like, what I also like about the drawings and the architects could deal with it was the poverty of our software efforts. You know, we had so little time. We're competing with gas companies who have the most amazing equipment for making these absolutely non-empirical, anti-scientific images of their own work. And the kind of crass clunkiness of our drawings, I think, are just as clunky as their drawings. So there's something about pointing to how stupid all of the drawings are is kind of part of it somehow. But I think that's a bit more obvious. Like, the film, I think, will only ever be exhibited with the drawings. I'm not sure I'll show the film. I mean, I'm showing it now because it's like a work in progress, but also I'm interested in feedback as well because I haven't finished the cut. But yeah, I think there's a process of generation that now is like ending because when I started, I didn't think that they were going to. You know, it's a critique of this kind of white environmentalism, but now the complexity of the movement is much, you know, it's there's much more Aboriginal involvement, and the insidiousness of the white management is just more, you know, extreme somehow. Yeah.
Did somebody else want to give a feedback about the?
If someone from the audience wants to say something, I mean, I think I wanted to go back to what you were saying earlier, this issue of commodifying your practice and how, I mean, this conflict that, I mean, it's something that we have been discussing actually over and over, you know, the conflict that we have between our art practices and our interest in activism and how we find ourselves in this place of, and I mean, I question that because it's like, you know, the contradiction of always, you know, our practice also producing these kind of products, of cultural products that get commodified and get, you know, how to cope with this conflict. And I think this is an issue that that interests me a lot. I don't think it's to solve. I think it's important to have it latent there, and sometimes I'm interested in like dysfunctioning, you know, like not working well, or you know, how can we, you know, create modes of disruption of this kind of like commodifying of activist work that becomes staticized. And yeah, so how, you know, I think this is a very important issue, and I know that we have been, you know, like it's a continuous discussion.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't call myself an activist because I'm not blockading anything, and I'm not. I mean, you know, when I film things, I trespass, and that's the limits of my activism, right? But I, you know, I do. Being outside of Australia made it much easier for me to see what was going on, and it gave me more time to go in and out of this crazy space and, you know, fully kind of immerse myself in very different, like the different constellations of what's there, and then leave and take the time to come back. So the slowness of it, and the fact that I, you know, it took 4 years for me to be comfortable being funded to do this research, right? Because I often am uncomfortable being paid to do this research, basically. The most meaningful presentation by far was when I went back to my hometown and I exhibited the work there in the museum that's sponsored by Rio Tinto, right? Rio Tinto didn't give me any money, but I put it in the Rio Tinto Museum. And in that exhibition space, the woman who was the only full-time environmental activist in my hometown turned up alongside the Aboriginal elders, alongside a whole bunch of guys from the industry, families that knew each other that, you know, kind of hate each other for their relationship to the local mines. And they all had, you know, met each other inside of the analytic that was set up by my exhibition, but the analytic only comes from conversations with all those people that I'm putting into these 9 different diagrams, and the total picture adds up to something that includes all their perspectives on this singular situation. At the opening, Juliri, who I mentioned at the start, did the talk, and she started by addressing herself to the local arts representative there from the government, and he, crazily, used to be the director of the Comalco mine that took away all of her fishing areas in Gladstone in 1963, right? So, you know, this industry is not news to Aboriginal people. This is just a repetition of everything that has come before, and they retired from their own activism like 30 years ago. But a lot of Aboriginal people have trouble, particularly in regional areas, talking against mining industries because the state is so racist that this is the first time that they buy a house, right, from getting a job in these mines. So also for that reason, you know, she has kids that have that take these jobs that hate it, but they're happy for me to be in conversation. She's happy for me to be in conversation with her kids about the larger situation that is going on between all of these people. So anyway, she spoke for half an hour about the loss of her fishing grounds from the previous industry that wasn't my exhibition. And that was the most, you know, that was when I felt like I'd made some decision, you know, something had happened for that to happen in that situation. That was like completely what I was trying to do without controlling, what I was doing basically. But in terms of the bigger picture, I think, the more I stayed away from Australia, the more I realised there was research to do, particularly in like these regional areas. But I think there's a limit to what I can do by staying this far away for so long. So I think I either have to move back or, like, I've kind of reached the end of the first phase of what I felt like I could contribute between an extremely regional, non-capital city perspective on this place that is like fundamentally a massive part of the mining industry. The main moments when the project makes sense is when I'm talking to activists turn up to art spaces. So that happens in Australia a lot when I present it there. In Europe, I'm mostly doing very different work explaining the limits of like European Marxism to like left visions of industrial capitalism in the South, something like that. So this film is somewhere, like the audience of it is not entirely clear to me yet because it's trying to straddle speaking to an Australian settler audience, speaking to this attitude towards land that's global. But from the very beginning, the project didn't necessarily have an audience because I was trying to talk about the racism of the biggest the biggest social movement of the neoliberal era was the movement against this industry. So it was a moment of extreme hope and extreme racism this kind of white left depression around neoliberalism, basically. Yeah.
Hi, Rachel. I didn't see the presentation because I had a bad cold this morning, but I know about your practice. I know some aspects of your research. I'm interested in this idea of why making a film and to whom one is talking when one is working to bring a kind of greater knowledge to people who actually need it. So, you know, there is a long history of activist cinema or political cinema, which I would say is what the essay film could be or is in some cases. You know, I think a lot about the filmmaker Anand Patwardhan, that from India, his work, where the essay film, the documentaries that he makes in India, he's like the kind of, you know, elder statesman of sort of documentary in India, and his work has shown on Channel 4 with Black Audio Film Collective. You know, when I was growing up, he's also kind of like a distant relative, so I've known him since I was very young and watched him construct his practice. So the films, I mean, he's adamantly against the art world because he doesn't believe that anybody understands anything particular about anything in it, and especially when it comes to the Indian art world, he thinks it's just full of children all wanting to make big careers for themselves. And he stays out of it. Because when he made his last film on called Jai Bhim Comrade, on Bhimrao Ambedkar, the leader of the Dalit movement, the social kind of engineer, if you like, who managed to do these mass, these mass ceremonies where Hindus would basically become Buddhists in order to relieve themselves of the debt of Hinduism and fate of Hinduism, which means that they're just constantly untouchable. So mass conversions, untouchables become Dalits, and, you know, he was a very interesting person, Bhimrao Ambedkar. I mean, the film took 10 years to make, and it's like 3 or 4 hours long, and when he first showed it, he showed it in the slums in Bombay, where the story comes from, and 3,000 people came to stand and watch. The films are used as tools. They bring together a bunch of constituents who would never normally see each other, and all those people meet in the film. I mean, it's not just him. There are Black Audio Film Collective's early films before the art world, like Handsworth Song, you know, and others. Twilight City, which was about sort of the kind of early gentrification of London and how architecture is and race kind of determine a new landscape. These were films where, you know, and of course the whole Argentinian cinema movement, third cinema movement, Santiago Alvarez from Cuba. These films were designed to, and Berwick Street Collective in Britain and many other film, Sankofa as well, many other groups. They were creating an assembly of constituents in order to, like, put these different politics together. And, you know, of course, formally this bore a new language. It created a new aesthetic. It created a new language, but it was drawn from necessity as opposed to the art world. So I'm just interested in how I am interested in who your audience is. And I mean, for instance, again, I'll go back to Anand. When he's been making these films, you know in his films that he is talking to the people he's making the films about, because he's dealing with their relationship to images. So, you know, I remember in one film he made, Father, Son, and the Holy War, there's an image of a god throwing fire on a woman who's being burnt ritually, this ritual called Sati. And Anand goes and interviews this woman in the village who lives next door to the men responsible for committing this crime. And he asks her what she thinks, and she says, well, look, here's a postcard. Look, the god is doing it to this woman. It's not these men, it's the god. So, you know, she's a poor, ignorant village woman who doesn't understand the difference between images and reality, but that is the fact of her life. So, you know, I think the global contemporary art world can be a real distraction in terms of what's the messages in the work.
So just to respond to that, I probably should have mentioned, but I don't like qualifying things, right? Because that's what the film looks like right now. But I got 4,000. I asked for 8,000. I got 4,000. You know, 2 months before I had to finish the whole thing. And this is like one cell of a longer project that actually, the longer project has a budget for me to go back and speak to all the people I've been speaking to for 7 years, right? But the reason that I... There's two reasons why I think talking in art space about this stuff is absolutely essential. One is that in Australia... you know, there's been a boom for more than 20 years, and until the fracking, hardly anyone that was called themselves a professional cultural industry worker was speaking about the extent of money that was funding the entire Australian art industry. That's one part of it. Like, most Aboriginal art prizes are sponsored by mining companies. Like, that's literally just the situation. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, that was the only space that would invite me to talk, and it wouldn't fund me. So I applied for a bit of money to make more work in Australia. I never got any of those applications approved. I kind of appreciated that I didn't, because there's just not that much independence in the Australian art scene as such, in terms of lots of people don't make work if they don't get funded for it, right? There's hardly any ambitious work that is being self-funded over especially over long durations. I think it's going to be, you know, because I'm not a filmmaker, it's going to take me a while to do something with cameras that is appropriate to the conversations that I've already been having for 7 years. So until now, you know, the space of exhibition has been the space of assembling people that are much more important in terms of public communication. So I do think that, you know, art space is just this residual fictionally public space that we need to use. If only artists turn up to my talks, then I know that I'm making the wrong work, right? And so that's how I deal. Like, you know, it was the place, you know, once I quit my museum job, that just was my cultural capital to go back into that space with a totally other project that was talking about the infrastructural conditions without just being like institutional critique as a genre, basically. Yeah.
Thank you, Rachel. We have to skip to the next conversation, but I think we didn't totally answer all the questions. I think the presentation that we're going to have during, especially this morning, will be an occasion to continue to talk about a lot of things. So I think Angelica switched really quickly to talking about Black Audio Film Collective, which has nothing in relation with, I think, what we see, because I think it's totally the exactly opposite of what we see, I think so. So I think it will be nice perhaps to come back to it, because I think that question of bringing together some existing matter and try to recreate some kind of empowerment of that and using a body things about images, which is not exactly what modelization is doing, or perhaps we can talk about what kind of empowerment and embodiment creates a modelization. And for perhaps we'll keep in mind, because I think the different presentation we got this morning try to do something with synthetic drawings, with the redrawings of the real. And so it would perhaps would be nice to try to come back to that question of that specific language, what is its capacity, and why it's different than an assemblage of the moving images. Because it's a drawing, and yesterday Christa Blumlinger talked about Aaron Farouk installation and making the difference between the design of the video games and the recording of the films. So there is that question to be in print somewhere, and to be designed, which is different, I think, gesture. So let's keep it in mind, and we're going to see one film of the Lorenzo Pezzani and Charles Hellers. Lorenzo can be with us on Skype, as I told you, because he's in the plane, unfortunately. But I think his film could be a way to continue the conversation that will be also fed by the Margarita Mendez presentation, I think. Perhaps try also to keep that idea that the conversation could be also on what Gojo tried to open a politic of the aesthetics, and not only about the reception of the piece, but also its form. But there is, I think, two new things that could be introduced with the two next presentations we're going to see, is also the using of the internet as a space of the diffusion and distribution of that images that create perhaps another regime of their existence and of their using. So we will see one of the two films we not to present it. It's the most well-known, called Liquid Traced, The Left to Die Boat Case. And so it's a film by Charles Lorenzo Pezzani, and the attempt with that film to create a kind of synthetic reconstitutions of events happens on the sea, and it's a boat with 72 passengers who have been left, which left the Libyan coast, heading in the direction of the island of Lampedusa, on board a smaller rubber boat. And so they try also to create a kind of inquiry, and witness is the sea by itself. And they try to show how finally we can find traces on the seas as an element that can fit our understanding of some situation. So they propose something else, and they use all the tools that are already existing to control and to design a situation in the Mediterranean seas.
Closest vessels appearing in the image from the 29th of March were only 40 kilometers away and could have reached a migrant's boat in less than 2 hours. While these remote sensing technologies are usually used for surveillance, they are here repurposed as evidence of guilt. Abandoned to the winds and currents, they became prisoners of their frail boat, chained to the sea's open expanse. The sea became an unwilling killer, and yet it is also a witness of the events, which, interrogated for us by an oceanographer, has revealed the drifting boat's trajectory. According to the reconstructed trajectory, the migrant's boat did briefly enter the Maltese search and rescue zone, but was soon pushed back out of it by southeast winds and currents that would continue for the next 14 days. For several days, the passengers drifted in bad weather. Left without food or water, the migrants began drinking seawater as well as their own urine. After 2 to 3 days, they started dying one by one. During the night, Dan Haile Gebre remembers seeing the lights of other big boats in the distance. In the attempt to come closer to these vessels, 4 people started paddling with their bare hands, but the ships continued their swift course. The sea is in a rhythmic space of hierarchized mobility, speedy and secure for certain goods and privileged passengers, slow and deadly for the unwanted. After 5 to 6 days of drift, half the passengers had passed away. It is then, in a dead calm sea, that the migrants' vessel encountered a military ship.
This one is the boat of Hype, okay? Uh-huh. The ship was there, okay? The ship, okay?
You mean this distance?
No, it's very long distance, almost 700 meters, something. But they are watching that, okay? So, they met a rotation
around your
around it, okay. At the third one, they come like this.
Very close.
Yeah, very close, around 10 meters or 9 meters. We cannot close to them because it's too much. The weather is not good.
Sure.
We are just watching them. People is dying. Okay? And also children. Some people are drinking water, crying, something like that. So they are asking them for help, but they didn't get as anything, only taking pictures.
Despite witnessing the passengers' suffering, the military vessel left without providing them with any assistance. In so doing, it murdered them without touching their bodies. The identity of the ship remains undisclosed to this day. There were, however, several frigates deployed at the time that resembled the two-step structure forever imprinted on Don Haile Gebre's memory. The presence of several vessels in the area was again confirmed by satellite imagery analysis. What is the identity of all these ships? Which of these returns might, for instance, correspond to the Spanish Mendez Nunes and the Belgian Narcisse, both confirmed to have transited through this area during these days? After the military ship left, the passengers lost all hope. As they continued their deadly drift, they grew closer to the Libyan coast. Don Haile Gebre recalls seeing buildings at night. While the driver believed this was Malta, some Nigerians on the boat said, "No, these are the hotels built by Gaddafi in Tripoli." By this time, most of the remaining passengers had lost consciousness. On the 10th of April, the boat finally washed ashore in Zlitan, with 11 people alive. One woman died on the beach, and another man in prison after they were locked up by the Libyan military. The 9 survivors would be released 5 days later. For 14 days, the passengers had slowly drifted in the most surveyed waters on Earth. Despite repeated contacts, 63 passengers were killed by the reluctance of all actors to rescue them. Yet 9 people did survive to tell their story. By assembling their testimonies with the digital traces left by the events, we were able to map the trajectory of their boat across the liquid geography of the sea. Every point and every line drawn on this map seeks to inscribe responsibility in a sea of impunity. On the basis of our report and several other investigations, a coalition of NGOs has filed legal cases against the states participating in the military operations in Libya. While our reconstruction of the events has not been contested, the crime of non-assistance has so far remained invisible to the law. 1,500 other deaths were documented in 2011 amongst those fleeing Libya across the sea. 14,000 deaths have been documented at the maritime borders of the EU over the last 20 years. Many more remain silent in the sea's depth, killed by a selective and militarized mobility regime which has turned a perpetual flow of currents into a deadly weapon.